I wanted to finish up a little bit where we left off last week. So we discussed last week about Marisayan, about the issues of Marisayan going into a non-kosher restaurant, and whether that would be a violation of Marisayan, whether that would be a concern. You have to be concerned about Marisayan, but how it looks to other people who see you going in. First I wanted to just correct something that I said last week. I kept saying in the name of Rav Soloveitchik that going into a non-kosher restaurant in New York City would not be a problem all the time. I didn't hear that in the name of Rav Soloveitchik. I heard that from Rav Schechter. In his opinion, nowadays, in the time of Rav Soloveitchik, I don't know what he said. So I didn't mean to be quoting Rav Soloveitchik's position on the matter. So I just wanted to just clarify a little bit. We had some issues last week trying to figure out how far do you have to go to be concerned about what other people are going to think. Meaning, do I have to be worried? Somebody might see me doing something. What do I have to worry about people thinking? Do I have to worry about, you know, the farthest possible issue that somebody might suspect that I'm doing? That, you know, I'm walking in somewhere, like somebody said, to a supermarket. Do I have to be concerned that if I'm going into a supermarket, somebody might think that I'm buying not kosher food because they sell not kosher food? Somebody could think that. If I'm by the Stop and Shop deli counter, the people are going to say they have to stay 5 feet away from it. I mean, do we go that far to say, or do we say, no, I can go into the supermarket, I can even pass by
the lobster aquarium.
Can I say, do we say that, or do we say that if somebody sees me near the lobsters, they might think that, you know, it might be far off, it might be a 1%, but if there's 1% of a person who thinks that I'm doing something wrong, maybe they'll think I'm doing something wrong. Do I have to be concerned about that? So basically, where do we draw our line? Right? Where is the, what type of actions fall into this category of Maris Ayin that we have to be concerned, and what doesn't? So I think that it might be, there might be different, I think there are different opinions about this. I'll present two. I didn't see anybody discuss it outright, explicitly, where exactly we draw the lines, but I'll offer two, what I think are two different positions. One is that of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes, and he has a number of tshuvas about this, and Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that he doesn't think that a person should go into a non-kosher restaurant because he thinks it would be a problem of Maris Ayin, unless it's a situation of tsar or hefsed, a person going to lose his job, or a person in a terribly uncomfortable situation. He's so hungry he's allowed to go in to buy something kosher, like a drink or something, but only in a situation of tsar. And he says the reason for this is because the most likely reason that a person goes into a restaurant is to buy the food there. So I go with the most likely scenario. What is the most likely reason that a person is going into this place? So if it's into a non-kosher restaurant, the most likely reason for a person going to a non-kosher restaurant is to buy the food. Now, not so much for an Orthodox Jew, but somebody who sees me go in to a non-kosher restaurant will think, well, what else do you do in a restaurant? You buy food there. So his opinion, his position seems to be that it depends on what is the most likely. Right? There's one, I can categorize this in one way. For example, let's take it back to one of the Gemaras we discussed last week.
Going to a coffee shop. Like a Dunkin' Donuts or something. Not kosher Dunkin' Donuts, you're going to get a coffee.
Right, so it's a good question. Right? Where would you draw the line there? Right. So the most likely thing that you would go in to buy is probably a donut. Right? Or maybe not.
Coffee.
Yeah. So right, so it's hard. Obviously there would be gray areas. How do you define what's the most likely
reason?
That's
like a coffee
shop.
You go to the coffee shop for coffee.
Right. So if it's a coffee shop, then if it's Starbucks, so most people go to Starbucks for a coffee. What?
They
sell other stuff, and usually it's not kosher. Even not all the coffees are kosher, but for another time. But the most likely reason for a person to go in there would be for the coffee. So Rav Moshe Feinstein would let's take the Gemara, for example. We had a Gemara last week. That one of the Gemaras that discussed Maris Ayin, the Gemara said that if you fall into a river on your way home from shul on Shabbos, don't hang your clothing out to dry in a public place because people will think that you washed your clothing on Shabbos. Why do I have to be concerned that people will think that I washed my clothing on Shabbos? Maybe people will think that I fell into a river, I fell into a puddle, right? Or I spilled something on myself. Why can't I say, well, people will probably assume that I spilled something on my clothing on Shabbos, and therefore I'm hanging out. Why do I have to assume that people will think that I washed my clothing on Shabbos if they see it hanging out? So the answer is because the most likely reason why you're hanging out, the most likely reason why your clothing is wet is because you washed it. Most people don't have most clothing hanging on the clothesline is wet because you washed it, not because you fell into a puddle. Right? That would be the most common reason why it's wet. So if that's the case, that's why it would be Maris Ayin if it was wet for another reason than to hang it out to dry. He does say, however, that something which is obvious and meforsome, that it's so common, everybody knows that it's okay, but a few people will misinterpret it to think that it's a problem, that's okay. And he's discussing there, it's very interesting, tshuva. Somebody wrote to him about driving to shul on Friday afternoon, after candlelighting. Can you drive to shul after the time of candlelighting? Candlelighting is 18 minutes before sunset. So normally women accept Shabbos with candlelighting, and the men go to shul and accept Shabbos with Kabbalah Shabbos, let's say. So can a man drive to shul after his wife lights candles? Let's say in our shul, we dive in 10 minutes after candlelighting. So you can get into the car and drive to shul with enough time after your wife at home lit candles, can you go to shul? So somebody answered Moshe Feinstein this question because they saw him driving to shul on Friday afternoon. They wanted to know if it's an issue of Maris Ayin. And it's an amazing tshuva, because in the tshuva he basically says to him, I'm so thankful that you so badly want to do the right thing, and you so badly, if somebody's doing something wrong, you want to tell them, that you want to tell me that I was doing something wrong in a nice way, but it's mutter. That's basically what he says. Now, he says the reason why it's okay is because everybody knows that Shabbos does not start at candlelighting, and everybody knows that men go to shul.
Everyone knows
this. His tshuva is that everybody knows.
And everybody uses their 18 minutes.
Everybody knows. And he says that everybody knows that if I'm going to accept Shabbos when I'm in shul.
And everyone knows what happens when you assume.
And I hold a bit of time.
So Rav Moshe Feinstein writes. He says, so something which is obviously okay, that everybody knows is okay to drive to shul before Shabbos starts, as long as you didn't accept Shabbos, that is not a problem in Maris Ayin, because one person might think that it's wrong. He says, but since you thought that maybe it would be wrong, I'll stop driving to shul. That's
what you driving home. And we're not on our horses. So.
So he was saying, it's okay, it's mutter, but since you thought I might be doing something wrong, I'll stop driving to shul. Because I don't want anybody to think that I'm doing something wrong. And I appreciate that you're trying to tell me what to do. And it's a very nicely written sentence. It was with the Gadol HaDor. So obviously he wrote a very nice tshuva. But it's just a very interesting give and take.
Is that actually doing it to Chepper Rav Moshe, or is he doing this to...
I don't think so. Trying to give him a hard time. I think just he was trying to write
like
in.
Student to his father.
He thought it was a problem. He thought maybe it was a problem and wanted to bring it to his attention. Anyway, so that's what Rav Moshe finds. That's his position, that you go by what is the most likely thing you're going to do in this store. Now, it seems from other tshuvas that others would have a different approach, that it's not that you would define every action as, this is the most likely thing that will happen in this store, and therefore I'll define this as either Maris Ayin or not, because there's one thing that you're going to do in here. But rather that it depends on, is it common for you to do one of two things or one of three things in this store. And once it's common to do a few things in this store, then it's not a problem of Maris Ayin. For example, or I'll give you the reverse example. The Gemara discusses a case of drinking fish blood. Now, fish blood of kosher fish is okay, right? You can drink it because it doesn't need shechita. Right? Fish does not need shechita, so you can drink fish blood. However, the Gemara says that it would be, or the Shulchan Aruch writes that it would be marasayin to put fish blood into a cup and to drink it. Why? Because people might think that you're drinking animal blood. Right? And animal blood you're not allowed to drink. Why do I have to be concerned that somebody would be drinking animal blood? Why wouldn't I say, well, of course, they'll know this is fish blood. So the reason is because it's such an uncommon, it's not a common drink to drink fish blood or animal blood, that there's no reason to assume one or the other. It's not common to have fish blood on your table. Now, compare that to, after a fleishig meal, you have a small pitcher of white liquid on your table to serve with your coffee. Now somebody might come in and say, why is there milk on your table? You just had fleishigs. Right? So why is that not marasayin? So the answer is because everybody knows that that could be creamer. Right? Non-dairy creamer is such a common...
or cheesecake.
Or part of cheesecake, right? Or part of ice cream.
Nobody would think,
right?
Oh, you're getting
part of ice cream, which is something that's commonly served after a fleishig meal. Everybody would say, of course I know that there, it must be part. Why don't I have to be concerned that there's somebody who might be seeing and say, oh, look, they must be drinking animal blood, just like, and not fish blood, and they must be having milk with their coffee, or real cheesecake, or real ice cream after their fleishig chalent. So the reason is because when something is so is common, and now is it more common to have dairy non-dairy creamer than milk? Is it more common to have parve ice cream than regular ice cream? I don't think so, right? It's not more common to have one or the other, but it's very common, and everybody knows that such a thing exists, that it would not be a problem of marasayin, which I think means that as long as there's a reasonable something that you're doing which is reasonable, that people know about and can expect and assume that you can say this is not marasayin, right? As long as that would be mutter. So now applying that to our situation of going into a non-kosher restaurant for a business meeting, so I think that it's like we said, in New York City, I think it's known and accepted that people go into non-kosher restaurants for business meetings. So if that's the case, now is it more common if you had 100 people walking in, how many of them would be going in for business meetings? How many of them would be going in to eat? I think more would be going in to eat the food than going in for a business meeting. However, it's normal and accepted and known that people do go in also for business meetings, which means that since it's a reasonable purpose for going into this, for going into this restaurant, that it would not be a problem of marasayin according to that opinion. It's similar to, let's say, a cafeteria, right? In a cafeteria, in a business cafeteria, so in the cafeteria they sell many non-kosher items, but there are some items there that are being sold that are kosher, right? They may sell some prepackaged sandwiches, they may sell cookies, they may sell some yogurts, they may sell some ice creams, prepackaged things which are kosher. So if somebody sees a person, a Jew, going into the cafeteria, so he could think, now again, more likely, the most likely thing that they'd be doing there is eating non-kosher, because most people who go in there are eating non-kosher. But since it's reasonable that a person can go in there and find something that is kosher, it would not be a problem of marasayin to buy some food there and sit there and eat. Right? Because it's a reasonable and common and common to go in there and eat something which is kosher. The Gemara, the Rush, discusses the case of there was a time that the rabbi said, don't make a garment with silk. Don't make a wool or linen garment with silk, because silk was not common at the time, and they were worried that it would be marasayin, and people might think that silk is, if it's a wool garment, they'll think the silk is linen and it's chatnez. Or if it's a linen garment, they'll say that silk must be wool and it's chatnez. Now, the Rush writes that was true when silk was not a common material to use in garments. But now, the Rush says, nowadays it's very common and everybody knows about silk and everybody knows that you use silk for clothing, that it would not be a problem of marasayin to put silk into a linen or wool garment, because everybody knows it's common to use that in your clothing. So again, I think it's a little bit different than what Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote. It could be Rav Moshe Feinstein would agree to this. It could be he meant this. It's not, and it's hard to know, in just gleaning from his tshuvas always, exactly how he would formulate it. But it, many others seem to say that if it's a commonly accepted and reasonable activity to be done in the place that you're going, that it would not be Marasayan. But there might be people who think you're going in there to do something wrong. That's true, right? But we're not concerned about the people who will not take the reasonable action that you could be doing, which would be a kosher action, a mutter action, into account when you go in there to do whatever you're going to do. So I think those are, you know, two different ways of looking at the whole broader topic of how to define an action, whether it falls into this category of Mars Ayin or not, whether it's the, it depends on whether, you know, is it the most common thing to do here, or it, does it depend on something which is, just has to be reasonable? And if there's an, a reasonable action that I could be doing in there, which is allowed, then it's mutter to go in there, and it's not a, a problem of Mars Ayin. So that's just to kind of finish up last week. Now, so moving along, I thought the next thing we would talk about is the big question about taking off your kippah, whether you should wear your yarmulke when going into one of these restaurants or not. So I did not find any tshuvas that dealt explicitly with that question as to whether you should take off your yarmulke if you're going in for a business meeting. Now let's assume that it's you're allowed, right? It's mutter to go into, let's assume, moving forward we'll go under the assumption that it's not Maris Ayin to enter into the non-kosher restaurant for the business meeting. And it was asked last week about what about out of town. So I'm not sure because in New York City it's accepted, it's reasonable, it's common that people go to these, you know, whether it's a holiday party or whether it's a business meeting for a lunch or a dinner. And they go into these, and therefore if somebody sees a person walking in with a yarmulke, they will probably think, oh, they must be going in there for a business meeting. But what about in Tulsa, Oklahoma, or wherever, Illinois, right? I forgot the town, Illinois, that was asked about last week. So I'm not so sure, because first of all, there are no Jews there, right? In these areas, there are no Jews, I think, right?
Well, there's Jews.
There is not that many.
There are
not like in the concentration.
Right.
So
right.
No problem.
Right. So, no, I just wonder if, you know, I've been Yemen asked about that. I forgot where he goes. Illinois. Somewhere
Chicago.
Illinois. He said there's no Jews. So there's never anybody. So in a place like that, where there's no Jews, and the only people who are going to be see you going in here are the non-Jews that you work with, and you always wear your yarmulke there, let's say. So I'm not sure if it's Maris Ayin to then go into one of these restaurants to sit and have a drink while they eat lunch, because in that situation, you know, or into the cafeteria where you could buy a yogurt with an OU on it, or a candy bar with an OU on it, you know, something like that. I don't think that would be Maris Ayin, because if there was a Jew there, they would come over and say to you, do you know where I can get kosher food? Right? I'm also looking for kosher food. Can I get kosher food here?
They see you sitting inside there with the yarmulke, and they happen to be looking for kosher food and go, hey, there's someone in there. Oh, this is kosher. And then they go
underneath. Yeah, they might.
That's
right.
What I'm saying.
They might. Or they might say, there must be kosher food here. Let me ask him. Right? Because in a place like that, when a place is completely out of town, where if you bump into somebody with with a yarmulke, you feel more comfortable going over to them and talking to them, even if it's a complete stranger, just because.
Landsman.
Right. It's just, you know, you feel like it's
like in the Frisco Grid.
Exactly. Landsman, do you remember that?
Yeah.
Okay, I don't know. I'm just saying, I'm not so sure. I'm not sure whether it would go. I think you can, you know, there's what to talk about in either direction. But to a certain degree, it could be they'll see it, they'll say, oh, it must be kosher, I can get kosher food here. But I think most of it would, I would think that if I saw somebody, I wouldn't think that, oh, it must be you can get kosher food here. I would think, oh, let me go ask him what's kosher here. Right? And if I can get kosher food here. Not just to jump in, especially if you see him sitting there with, without anything on his plate, or you see him sitting there with a candy bar, and everybody else is having a sandwich or a plate of food. So if it's obvious that it's different, so then again, I wonder. It's just I don't think it's so clear. Now, so what about taking off your kippah? So let's say you have to go into one of these business meetings. Should you take off your yarmulke in order to go in for the business meeting, or leave your yarmulke on? So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a number of tshuvas about taking off your yarmulke in certain situations. He has four tshuvas, but basically two of them are the same and two of them are the same. So it's basically two different questions that he was asked twice. One question that he was asked was, if a person is going to an inappropriate place, let's say a nightclub, should he not wear his yarmulke when he goes to the nightclub? And that was a question that Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked. So Rav Moshe felt that he basically says, just because you're going to do one thing wrong doesn't mean you should do two things wrong. Right? So just because you're going to the nightclub doesn't mean you should also then take off your yarmulke. That was what he thought. He said, unless a person knows that they're going to go to this nightclub and they truly really are doing it l'shem shamayim, they're really doing it for the virtuous thoughts and feelings that I don't want to defile Hashem's name, I don't want to make a chilul Hashem there. If that's the case, he says, then he can't take off his yarmulke. But he said it's very hard to, it's a little bit of a stretch to imagine that a person would have such altruistic motives if in that type of situation. It's possible. It's possible. People have their misyonos that make it a little bit more difficult in certain situations. But he felt that in that situation, unless the person really had altruistic motives of not making a chilul Hashem, but he was going to go anyway, so then he said that it's better to leave it on and feel uncomfortable, probably, rather than to take it off. That was one
question.
Yeah. So that was one question that was asked. The other question, which is probably a little bit more appropriate for and connected to our topic, is he was asked if a person felt, and I don't know the year that this was asked, I didn't check the date, if a person felt that if he were to go on the business interview wearing his yarmulke, that he wouldn't get the job. Or he felt that he couldn't wear his yarmulke at work because he would either lose business or lose his job, right? And that was, I think, more of a concern when he was being asked questions 40 years ago, 50 years ago, but still in some places, in some professions, it's still a concern.
I actually have a question about that today from a non-religious Jewish person, because there's another religious person now in my office. And he didn't wear a yarmulke, so this other guy said, well, why is he not wearing a yarmulke, but he got the kosher food?
It's confusing.
Yeah, it's very confusing.
And it can be confusing, and it's important to try to stay consistent, because otherwise they can start questioning. Well, you need to leave early on Friday, and if you want to bother us to get you the kosher food, but you don't want to, come on, you can't be that serious. Right. That could be hard. What'd you answer? I'm joking.
I'm such a local authorized rabbi.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good answer. No, it's a good question.
I think if you're working in an environment where people see you wearing a yarmulke, and then you're going out to lunch, and then suddenly you take off your yarmulke, that's almost like a chilul Hashem, because they're saying, wait a minute, why is he doing that?
He must be doing something wrong. Right, that's true. Right.
I find a lot nice more people did it when the army that worked.
It's true. It does depend on the work.
You see older people working for companies for 30 years, you see them now wearing the army, because they see people now who are
right. It
younger.
Could be a generational thing. It could be generational that
actually,
nowadays it's much
long
more
long
much more accepted.
In the New York area, I had experience down in D.C. where a potential employer definitely gave me a hard time.
Did they?
Yeah.
See, so it does exist. Could be in New York.
Early on a Friday.
Right.
So Lieberman doesn't wear yarmulke in Congress.
Should say you're a Muslim.
Yeah.
You know what I can tell you? My father was in Stony Brook. There aren't a lot of Jews around there.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And he was telling me that he has a problem with it.
He does.
Yeah.
Because
They come in and they look and they're like, come even ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
I work
even
in the Bronx.
Even as close to Stony Brook. I only work in the Bronx.
And patients would try to be Makar of me or, the Jewish doctor. And it would just be like, you couldn't do anything right.
Mm-hmm.
I find that older doctors don't wear their yarmulke, because the younger ones do. That's what I find a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The ones that have been around for 30 years doing, in their practice,
Yeah. So again, it does depend on the workplace. So well, let me tell you what Moshe answered. So Rav Moshe answered that there are two different opinions about wearing a yarmulke. He says one opinion is that it's a minhag, and it's a very old minhag, and it's a very widely accepted minhag, and it's a minhag that we take seriously. Right? Minhagim we don't just dismiss easily, but it is a minhag, and the minhag based on the word yarmulke comes from the word yiras malka, because the purpose of the fear of the king. Yiras Malka. So the purpose of the yarmulke is to remind us and to help our fear of God. And the Gemara discusses it already, discusses the yarmulke, and tells a story about a young Amora, I believe. I don't remember which one, but when he was young, that he was a great boy, and he never did anything wrong as long as he wore his yarmulke. And then when he took off his yarmulke, he accidentally was Mechal Shabbos or broke something. And they said because he wasn't wearing his yarmulke, he didn't have that same level of awareness of God, didn't have that same level of fear of God as when he was wearing his yarmulke, when he wasn't, when he was. So the yarmulke certainly is a very old Jewish minhag that we have. But if it's a minhag, so a minhag, in a situation of loss, of financial loss, so even certain times a rabbinic decree is pushed aside for a loss. So certainly a minhag would also be able to be pushed aside for in a situation of loss. So the problem is the second reason why we wear a minhag is because it's chukas akum, it's following in the ways of the non-Jews to go with a bare head. Now that was the opinion of the Taz. That it's chukas akum. We know there's an issur in the Torah of following in the ways of chukasayim lo selecha. You shouldn't go in the ways of the non-Jews. Now the Taz is of the opinion that to go without anything on your head would be following in the ways of the non-Jews. That is not the accepted opinion. And even if that was the accepted opinion, Rav Moshe writes that nowadays it certainly is not the way of the non-Jews in any religious meaning, but rather the reason why people, by non-Jews, don't wear anything on their head is because it's easier. It's more comfortable. They don't like wearing anything on their head, so why bother? So it's not really for religious purposes, and if it's not for religious purposes, so then it doesn't really fall into that category, and there's a whole discussion about it, so which we won't have now. But so Rav Moshe writes that really we don't follow that opinion, and even if we did, it would probably be okay nowadays because it wouldn't be such a strong position. So therefore he writes that since really it's only a minhag, in his opinion, that wearing yarmulke is only a minhag, therefore in a situation where a person feels that he'll lose his job or lose business, that he does not have to wear yarmulke. That was the answer that he was given. Right? So it's not exactly connected to our discussion tonight, to our topic tonight.
It's hard to quantify. Like, how do you know if you're losing business? Because like, I wouldn't know.
Right, you don't know. What? You don't know.
It's like I could assume.
And it's going to ice slip some far out place in long.
It's a sense.
Or after a loss of experience, like after you lose some business.
But again, you wouldn't be able to isolate to that.
No, but I think what I'm saying is that once you're losing business, you might say to yourself, look, I could lose business.
Right.
But when the yarmulke,
because
then.
In other words,
in
hindsight.
When you start your job wearing yarmulke, are you then allowed to take it off?
I don't know why you would take it off at that point.
So let's say you felt that for some reason it was problematic towards business.
Mm-hmm.
But would that then, when you
start,
or
you might then lose
off,
your job?
Is it then more like a problem because then you're giving up?
Yeah, that's because if you're losing your job, then you're finding the wrong place.
It's
not so easy to,
It's not so easy to take
a job that you can get. You hold on to the job that you have. You try to make sure you keep the job that you have. I mean, and you have to do, if this is only a minute, so if it's causing a financial loss, so then yeah, you'd probably be able to take it off even. The only problem with taking it off would be, like Ariel was saying, that it gets confusing and contradictory, and then people start asking questions. Well, you used to wear it, and now you don't. So then you'd have to explain to them, I felt that it was hurting the firm.
Right, like I used to work for a company that did conferences.
Mm-hmm.
So in Manhattan, it's much easier to wear yarmulke than when you're conferencing or Orlando or San Francisco,
right,
or some random places,
right,
from all over the country.
Right. Right. So that, you know, there you have an answer. You know, it's not an inconsistency there, I don't think, as opposed to where, you know, there are different, where you're saying this is important, this isn't important. You know, if you say, well, I'm doing this, but we're losing business, so then I would imagine. That's not his question. His question is more, I think his question is about getting a job, trying to get a potential job. But I would imagine, I don't see why.
Absolutely.
Get the job without the yarmulke, but day one you have it, then it's like that.
No, then you won't last too long. So that being said, so Rav Moshe is right, that you can take off your yarmulke in that situation. Now, applying that then to our situation, now, not that that's recommended. I heard in the name of Rav Schechter that if you're doing something that you think you should take off your yarmulke, then maybe you should reconsider doing it.
Right?
If you're doing something that you think you should take off your yarmulke, maybe you should reconsider doing it.
Doing that action.
Right. Now, if it's a situation of financial loss, so then you don't have a choice. I could reconsider doing it, but if this is the only job I have, then, you know,
not much to reconsider.
Right. Yeah, you have to weigh your options. So that's just to set it in the situation, just to give a little background that it's not a lechatchila situation, right? It's not something we try to find a situation. It's not an excuse to take off our yarmulkes.
Right.
It would just be a consequence of other factors. Then, you know, it is what it is. So in this situation about going into a non-kosher restaurant with a yarmulke on, so if once we establish that it's not Maris Ayin to go into the restaurant with a yarmulke on, so if anything, it might then be Maris Ayin to go into the restaurant without the yarmulke on. Because then if somebody knows us, sees us going in without a yarmulke on, at that point they'll start becoming suspicious and saying, hey, you know, why did you take off your yarmulke to go into that restaurant? Maybe it's because you're going in there to eat. If you go with your yarmulke on and you walk in normally with your briefcase, and you know, they say, okay, maybe he's going for the business meeting. But if you go in there with your yarmulke, you take your yarmulke off when you go in, so then maybe that starts people to ask more questions, not less questions. You may be making more problems for yourself than solving. But again, it's really a judgment call. You know, if you're always wearing your yarmulke at work, so then I would imagine that you should probably leave it on then for the business meetings, even if they're taking place in a non-kosher restaurant. Because just for the consistency of, I'm not doing anything wrong being here with you, I'm not eating anything, but I'm not doing anything wrong being here with you in the non-kosher restaurant. It was raised last week, and I think it's a bigger Maris Ayin question, is if the business meeting is in a restaurant with a hashgacha, which not everybody relies on. Right? I think that's a bigger question. I think that's a more difficult question to answer and to get around. Because at that point, to go into a non-kosher restaurant with a yarmulke on, people will probably, they know you're going in there for a meeting, you're not going in there to eat. But if they see you going into a restaurant with a hashgacha that is not reliable, and not everybody relies on, and they see you have a yarmulke on, then they'll say, well, it must be that either this hashgacha is good, because look, that guy's going in there with the yarmulke on, or he must be eating at this hashgacha, which is not a reliable hashgacha, right? And that's where it gets a little bit more tricky. But then also, how could you take your yarmulke off, right? And there will be other people who are eating in there, maybe they'll know you. Maybe. So that's, I think, a little bit of a trickier question. I'm not sure exactly the answer and what the correct thing to do is, but if you have that situation, you should consulted your local Orthodox rabbi.
Isn't
this
why we're here?
If it comes up, you should consult. You should consult. Yeah, but that's about taking off your yarmulke. And then again, out of town, you know, also is not so clear. You know, is it the same? Is it different? You know, is it the same as wearing a yarmulke in New York City? Is it different than wearing a yarmulke in New York City? Specifically in a non-kosher restaurant, if a business meeting is in a non-kosher restaurant. You know, again, it's a little bit of a judgment call, and I don't have answers to all of these questions, but these are just some of the issues and the thoughts and the factors that go into it. So let's say you do go into this restaurant, and you do have to, and you do sit there, and you're sitting there with your yarmulke. What can you order? Which is what I thought we were going to talk about today. I guess that'll be the title for next week's show. do one more. It's only 9:20, yeah. So we'll do one more of this next week. We'll have to rush through some of these things. I have a long list of potential things that you can eat.
This is very
potential.
Good.
I said potential.
Very good.
And a long list of reasons why you can't. But I don't want to ruin it. Maybe there will be some things you can't.
That's week 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
This is my slate now.
I'm out of town those weeks.
in Tulsa. Yeah. So, okay, so let's start with something that you can have, and which is really the simplest, and that's a drink.
Yeah.
Right? A cold drink, right? Not an alcoholic beverage. We'll leave that for another time. That also we can discuss. But a cold drink, a soft drink. So this the easiest thing. You go into one of these restaurants and you get a cold drink. If it's from a can or a bottle, so then obviously you can drink it. You see the OU on it, and even or the Chaf K or the CRC, depending on the different whatever drink of your choice. If it's from a fountain, also the syrups on the fountain sodas. Are all most syrups, the Coca-Cola, Pepsi brands, and the 7-Up Dr. Pepper syrups are all, I saw the CRC has an article on their website, which is the Chicago Rabbinical Council, and they write on there that all the Coke products, Pepsi, Coke is under the OU, the Pepsi is under Rebbe Charlap, and Dr. Pepper 7-Up is under the CRC. So the fountain sodas are all fine also, as long as it's one of those, in one of those families, which usually they are.
How can you trust it to put the right syrup in?
Because you're buying Coke.
Because they're selling.
And if it's not Coke, then it's Pepsi. What else is going to taste like Coke or Pepsi? That's and true. Usually you see that, you know, you usually have
to taste like Coke or Pepsi.
Yeah, but fountain soda, Coke or Pepsi.
Right. I have a beer. Can you take a beer for a tap?
The beer, we'll have to talk about. Beer is an alcoholic beverage. That's a whole separate figure. That we can go through some of the sources on to understand it. So with a cold drink, a regular cold drink, a soda, a Snapple, or whatever, if it's from the bottle, you could drink it, obviously, you see. If it's from the fountain, also usually fine. The problem is the glasses. I'm using the glasses. The way I wrote about the glasses. Now, in order to use the glasses, so you would say to me, what's the potential issue with using a glass? So the potential issue is that it's possible to use this glass that they're going to serve you a soda in for something else. Right? We don't know what they do in the kitchens. I've heard that they use the mugs for soup and gravy, and you know they could use the glasses. They could have washed it with non-kosher food. It could have. You never know. So
it's glass.
It's
not.
Is the glass a problem?
Yeah,
of long-term
yeah
long-term
well, if it's
yeah
trafe, okay.
I thought
well, there's another thing. Let's say it's glass. The problem, let's say it's glass, and let's say in the glass there is some type of, let's say it's trafe glass, right? It's trafe glass. Somehow they used it for gravy, and so now it's not kosher, not a kosher
that
glass.
That glass doesn't have, can't get fed.
According, yeah, it
but
could be.
Thing, it's not
yeah.
It's a slice of milk, whatever you want.
Yeah. Some have that, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
In other words, well, they could have had a shrimp cocktail in there before, but it's not.
Yeah.
How did they clean it properly?
Well, also, so there are a few concerns. With anything, let's say it's not a glass. We'll keep it simple. It's a mug. Right, so let's keep it simple. It's a mug. So there are always two concerns with any type of kli. One is that there is taste, non-kosher taste, absorbed into the walls, which would make it a non-kosher glass. The second is that they didn't wash it or clean it properly, and therefore there might still be some small piece of whatever was in there, or some small piece of whatever it was washed next to in the cup. So those are the two concerns. So regarding the second one, so you know you can look and make sure that it's clean before you put the soda in, right? Before you open up the can and pour the soda in, just make sure that it's a clean cup. Regarding the first one, that it might have some trace taste absorbed into the cup, so that the way that taste is transferred when it comes to the halachos of kashrus is through heat, generally through heat. In order to transfer taste from a food into another food, or from a food into a kli, into a vessel, there needs to be heat there. has to be heat, which is the Yatzah Ledesbo, which is that a person will pull his hand back, let's say 120 degrees, 130 degrees, different opinions as to how hot Yatzah Ledesbo is. So if you have a cold soda, certainly there's no heat there. And if there's no heat there, then even if there is non-kosher taste in the cup, it cannot transfer from the walls of the cup into the soda. And therefore, you'd be able to use the cup. But a hot drink would be more of a problem, because a hot drink, then you have to be concerned. Then there's heat there that would transfer the taste from the cup into the drink. And again, if it's a coffee shop, and I can assume that they only use kosher coffees for this type of cup, then you can use it. The problem is a lot of coffee shops have non-kosher drinks, or have non-kosher coffees. Flavored coffees need hashgacha. So a place like Starbucks, Starbucks, I think all their coffees are under the OU. So if that's the case, then you know that they're using OU coffee. There is a whole controversy about Starbucks, that they wash them in the same dishwashers as the plates with the non-kosher food on it, but that's for another time. So we won't use Starbucks as an example. That's getting ourselves.
Starbucks gives you
separate.
The Starbucks gives you. They wash the dishes. They have the dairy thing, and
I don't know. It depends on what they serve. It's a whole. You can read up on it online. You can search the.
I don't want to read up
Starbucks controversy. So let's assume you go into a coffee shop, and if you know that the only thing they put in there is plain kosher coffee, so then you can use their mugs. The problem is they may use non-kosher creamer, and they may use, if it's a restaurant, they may use those same mugs for non-kosher food in the back. It's hard to know. You would think that they would only use the coffee mugs for coffee, but apparently it's not true. I heard from sources of people who've been in kitchens that it's not true. They use those same mugs for the gravy and for the soups and things like that, in which case you have non-kosher taste absorbed into the cups. If you want to have a cup of coffee, order it to go. Right? If you order it to go, they'll bring you a paper or a styrofoam cup. And then you just, I've changed my mind. And you sit there with the coffee in a styrofoam cup. Close your eyes.
Hotels give you, in your room, mug.
Hotels give you mug.
Yeah. General, can't drink a cup of coffee. It's not a mug.
A cup of coffee.
Very spoiled like that. I don't know.
For that.
So the coffee machine you could use. Because as long as there's only kosher coffee. Well, even if there's... Yeah, if they give you coffee, then you can probably assume that they're using it for the coffee and use the coffee machine. The question is the mugs. Can you use the mugs? So, again, it would depend. If they give you a few different choices of coffees to make there, and you see that they have the non-kosher coffee and the kosher coffee, so then maybe you should be concerned. But if they only have kosher coffees there, so then, probably. I think my initial reaction would be yeah, because you can assume that they're only using whatever the hotel provides for them, coffee. Most people don't bring coffee on their trips, so they use whatever the hotel gives you. So if you're using whatever the hotel gives, as long as you can, and you see the creamers called kosher creamer, and
then hotel give you paper cups also.
So then you can use those. Yeah, paper cups are good.
Can you use the glass in the hotel? Is there the glasses for water or no?
For water, for water. It's cold. Everything is cold. Oh. Yeah, anything that's cold, you can use it. Now, the one other concern when buying a drink, even a soft drink, is the lemon. Because even though I said that when it comes to the halachas of kashrus, the only way for taste to transfer from food to kli, to utensil, or from food to food, is with heat, the one exception is a davar charif. A davar charif is something, a sharp food. A sharp food, if it doesn't need heat to transfer taste, it needs the sharpness of the food and pressure of a knife. So if you have a non-kosher knife that at some point in its life absorbed non-kosher taste because you used it to cut a hot piece of meat or you used it with something hot, if you ever after that cut something, a davar charif, which is a sharp food, like a lemon, like an onion, like a scallion.
What are davar charif? Lime, lemon.
Lemon, lime, yeah.
Garlic.
Garlic, onion, scallion, radish.
Radish, which whole radishes?
Pickles, I think they say. Different opinions about it.
Whole radishes? So, you mean daikon? Like the white radish?
I don't know. I think they write radishes. I don't know what the details of what colors. And I can get you a list if you want. So if you cut a davar charif, so then the taste that's absorbed in the knife, non-kosher taste absorbed in the knife, will then transfer to the davar charif, right? Which is a source of a lot of questions in the kitchen. If you cut your part, you're using your milchig knife, and you accidentally cut an onion with your milchig knife that you wanted to put into your chalent, right? And you have a problem because even though it was cold, but it was a sharp food with your milchig knife, so now you have a milchig onion. And you wouldn't be able to put it in the chalent. So if the lemon is in the drink or on the cup, so if it's on the cup, you'd have to remove it and wipe it off. If it's in the drink, so that would be a question also. Now, the truth is that first of all, it may not be such a question because first of all, you can remove the lemon. So you remove the lemon and you have a little bit of taste in there. So the rule is when you have taste, let's say it's considered a non-kosher lemon. So if the taste that's imparted from the lemon into the soda is 1/60th of the soda, so then it's batel. It's nullified. It's as if it's not there. Right? If you have shishim, if you have 60 times, right? If you have a drop of milk that falls into cholent, but there's 60 times the whole cholent compared to the drop of milk that fell in, you're allowed to eat the cholent. It's as if the milk's not there. If a whole cup of milk fell in and there are only 30 cups of cholent, so then your cholent is basar chalav. Then it's milk and meat, and you can't eat it. If you can still taste lemon flavor. No. If it's something that the taste can still be tasted. No. Then it wouldn't.
If you could taste it, then it's more than...
Yeah.
Lemon's a very strong taste, isn't it?
Lemon's a strong taste,
yeah. Yeah. It may not even be
1/60.
Probably still
there, too. There's only Batul Shishim and Kashi,
and
now it's
Lemon's
powerful. Where's Batul Shishim? Is it worth
500?
That's
a real conservative.
Yeah, so hold on. So there's one other way out of it. And that is that the Shulchan Aruch discusses, the Ramah talks about a case where you're buying lemons or lemonade from where they used to buy it from non-kosher, from non-Jews. And the Ramah says that if they cut a lot of lemons at a time, so the taste from the non-kosher food is absorbed into the first few lemons, but then it's gone. It's no longer in the knife, and we don't have to be concerned about the schmutz on it. If it's a dirty knife, had non-kosher schmutz on it, you don't have to be concerned after the first few lemons that are cut that it was on the lemons. And then you have a whole big pile of cut up lemons, some of them which have the taste of the non-kosher knife, some of them which do not. So the rule is, when it comes to, if you have non-kosher and kosher mixed together, if it's not mixed together in taste, all you need is rove. If you have the majority rules there. So let's say you have two pieces of kosher meat, one piece of non-kosher meat, all in front of you, and they get all mixed together. The tastes do not mix up. They're all dry, and they're all cooked already, or they're all raw, but they all look the same. And I don't know which two of these are kosher and which one is not kosher. The halacha is that the one not kosher piece of meat is batel. It's nullified, and you're allowed to eat these pieces of meat. There are opinions as to whether you could eat all three pieces of meat together, because you know for sure that one of them is not kosher, right? So maybe you shouldn't eat all three together. Or maybe you should only eat two and throw one out, but you pick which one you want to throw out. Or maybe you can eat them all, but just eat them 1, 2, 3 separately. So there are all different types of...
Well, some you want to know rove anymore.
No, it's one... No, it is...
Original.
Right, the original one. It's a mixture. I say the whole thing is mutter. So I have three pieces of meat. So the same would be true about the lemons. If I have a few lemons and have some of the non-kosher taste absorbed into the lemon, and I have a whole bunch of lemons that don't have the non-kosher taste absorbed into the lemon, so then I would be allowed to say, well, most of the lemons don't have the non-kosher taste, and therefore all the lemons can be considered kosher. because the non-kosher ones would be nullified amongst the kosher ones, and therefore I'd be able to even eat these lemons, whatever you would do with the lemon. So that's only true if they cut a lot of them at the same time, right? Which is possible they do. Plus, they may have lemon knives, because as you said, the taste of a lemon is very, very strong. So you don't want to use your lemon knife, the knife that you just cut all these lemons up with. You're not going to then want to use it for a piece of bread, because then your bread will taste like lemon also. So it's very possible. There are a lot of factors to rely on, that if there's a lemon in there, you could take it out and put it on the side and it would probably be okay. Because it might be that they used a clean knife. If they used a clean knife, a lemon knife, a fruit knife, then it wouldn't be a problem. And even if they use a dirty knife, it's possible they cut a lot at the same time, and therefore the taste is gone and the schmutz is gone, and most of the lemons would be okay anyway. And even the ones that do have the taste absorbed would then be nullified amongst the ones that do not have the taste absorbed. So there's a lot of reasons to be lenient, but it depends on the place. Again, it would all depend on the place. But if there is a lemon that comes in your cup, it's probably not the end of the world. You could probably get around it. Or just order regular soda, and they probably won't bring you
lemon.
No lemon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rabbi, I have another question about that. When I go out to lunch with my firm, we go to a lot of trade places, unfortunately, and they'll get often like a pitcher like this, they'll fill it with Diet Coke, and they'll put like a lemon in it. So, I mean, should I tell them just to take it out, or I mean, would I be able to drink
that?
So in other words, if they pour from that and give me a cup, is that a problem? Because there's a lemon in there, but I don't necessarily even taste it.
Right, and plus it's probably
large.
Yeah, and if it's a big restaurant.
Yeah.
So again, probably. Cases that probably either a clean knife or they cut a lot of lemons or
lemon knife. Okay.
Yeah. So in most or
so
a clean knife
would be okay.
Probably.
Okay.
Probably.
Okay.
I think so. I have to check about the taste. If you taste it, it's still batel. Because there are spices that if the spices are in there, that they're not batel b'shishim.
Right.
Because if they have a very strong taste.
It's a good taste.
So I have to find out if the lemon taste is considered one of the tastes that's strong taste.
Right.
I have to check for next week. I'll check that out.
She heard something, I don't know if it's true or not, someone told me he's a Talmud from David, saying all the non-dairy flavor creamers, he said there's such a little amount of milk in them, they probably had them after me, probably, so batel b'shishim. I have to find out for sure. If you told me that
non-kosher dairy cream.
No, the kosher dairy for non-dairy creamer, but they have such a minute amount of milk in the actual product. By the time I put it in the coffee, it's possible to shoot.
And that's why they're allowed?
That's why you might be able to have them after me.
Non-dairy creamers?
Like the flavored non-dairy creamers they have that says OUD in them?
Oh, the ones that say OUD.
They have such a minute amount of milk in them.
Oh, I don't know. That I don't know.
I'll find out for sure if they had to, but I know that he told me something about
that.
Because I had it by my wrist, and he said, it's not really a problem.
You were saying about the dirt on the bottom of the cup. Isn't that also a case of batel b'shishim? If there's a drop of dirt on the bottom
so
of it,
if it's
and you're filling up with water.
Yes. So batel b'shishim really applies to taste, right? But if there's actually something there that you see, you can't say that it's batel b'shishim. Meaning, if you see a piece of, a piece of lobster in your cup, and you say, it's small. But yes, if there's something small on the bottom and you pour it in, you say, oh, I know there was something in there, and you pour it into another cup and you say, oh, now there's nothing there. Mm-hmm. It must be it got absorbed and, dissipated into this soda. Yes. But if there's actually something there that you see, even if it's 1/100th of the entire pot, you have to
take that
piece. Yeah. The pieces have to remove.
Can you make pot of position? Can you like...
No.
You
can't nullify something on purpose.
So if you have
Aim about when it's
a
is a general rule that you can't nullify in something which is forbidden l'chatchila, meaning on purpose. If it happens, it happens. You can't add, up to 1/60th of milk in my cholent because it tastes good. And hey, it's mutter because it's 1/60th of.
Well, that's because of one loaf, the big pile of chicken, but it's lifting milk cholent. So why don't you save the soup? Can you
yeah.
save the soup?
Actually.
But by adding on.
Add,
that's a separate
add,
question.
You add, you
adding
it in
Marvin Bashirim, yeah. Okay, that's.
You
in
don't
Marvin.
Because you know, it's a big monetary loss to the whole. Pot of soup.
Call your local Orthodox rabbi when that happens. If that happens, if that happens, call and ask a shiloh.
Yeah.
It could happen. It could happen. That's a separate. Yeah, that's a separate question. But you can't do it on purpose. To
saying you can't put a little milk in your
shalom. Right. You can't put a little milk in your shalom, even if it helps the texture. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So, all right, so I think we'll stop here. Mr. Shem, we'll continue next week.